The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Now I want to turn to the author of one of the most important books of the year. Ta-Nehisi Coates is a correspondent for The Atlantic magazine, and he's been writing about the persistence of racism in this country. His book, Between the World and Me, is written as a letter to his teenage son. After reading the book, Toni Morrison compared Coates to no less than James Baldwin, the great essayist and novelist whose work helped shape the civil rights movement. Just recently, Ta-Nehisi moved his family to Paris for a year, following in the footsteps of James Baldwin, who became an émigré in France in the 1940s. I sat down with Ta-Nehisi before he left the country to talk about Baldwin and his influence. I just wonder if we could start by your describing how you came to Baldwin and the effect it had on you.
Sure. It's an interesting thing. So my first memory of Baldwin is being a child. Yeah, James Baldwin books all over my house. My dad, you know, is very, you know, bibliophile, loved books, particularly collected books, buying about African Americans, Black diaspora. But I was a huge Malcolm X fan as a young man, and I heard a speech by Malcolm called "Message to the Grassroots," in which he gives a kind of a counter history of the March on Washington, his perspective on the March on Washington. And he had a line in there, and he said, they wouldn't let Jimmy Baldwin up there. He's talking about the roster of speakers because they didn't know what the hell he was going to say. And I knew Baldwin's name then, but that struck me. And it was like, oh, this Baldwin guy, he must be a little wild. Like, he must be a kind of out there. You know, and I didn't read any James Baldwin then. I would come across him when I was reading the histories and things like that. And I don't know why I picked up The Fire Next Time. I think the title is attractive. And I sat up in Founders Library. I picked the book up, and I read it in one straight sitting. And I didn't really understand it. I mean, I got it, but I had this emotional response to it. Yeah, that happens sometimes when you behold a piece of art. I guess it happens a lot. And you can't quite decipher it, but you know that you feel something. And I felt something tremendous from it.
Right.
I held that memory for a very, very long time. And I don't, you know, you don't know why you do these things. But recently, I'm talking about 2012, 2013, I went back to him. I had that thick volume, The Price of a Ticket, which was at that time his collected nonfiction. And he had an essay in it, Negroes are anti-Semitic because they are anti-white. He was a very, very, a staunch integrationist. But he had the kind of hard-edged pragmatism, I would say, as crazy as that sounds, that I always associated with nationalism. He had this view of power. You know, he wasn't clear that everything was going to end well, that everything was going to be okay. And he didn't do this sort of whole hubbub about how, you know, blacks and Jews were natural allies and, you know, this sort of, you know, overly sentimental thing. You know, he wasn't really into that. At the same time, the essay wasn't cynical. He just made this case that, listen, when Jews came to this country, they became white. And that's the nature of that's the dominant nature of the relationship between black and white people. And that essay, like, hit me so hard. You know what I mean? And I think it hit me hard because it was cutting. There's a way where you can be true, where you can, you know, get that kind of hard-edged spirit that you feel out of nationalism and still, you know, have a very, very, you know, serious look at the world and a humanistic, you know, view of the world. I got that from Baldwin. And then I didn't read it, you know, a Baldwin essay for about 10 years.
So in almost every standard collection of The Fire Next Time, it's preceded by a shorter essay called My Dungeon Shook, which is a letter from Baldwin to his nephew on the 100th anniversary of emancipation. And it begins, it has a passage that goes like this. I know what the world has done to my brother and how narrowly he has survived it. And I know which was much worse. And this is the crime of which I accuse my country and my countrymen, and for which neither I nor time nor history will ever forgive them, that they have destroyed and are destroying hundreds of thousands of lives and do not know it and do not want to know it. It is innocence which constitutes the crime. I have to say, when I read that, it goes to your biggest themes.
Yeah.
The link between you and Baldwin is deep and thematic and uses the same figures in a way.
It is. And that, like, to me, like, the most powerful part of it is the innocence which constitutes the crime. You know, I mean, that just hit me so hard. It is the desire, the attempt to not know. You know, it's like one thing to do something or to be a part of a group, a society, you know, a country, a state that does something, but then to pretend like you didn't do it, to pretend like you're fine, you're clean.
And what are the structures of white innocence in that sense?
Well, I mean, let's just go with the obvious one. I mean, we can talk more complicated than this, but the obvious one is we just saw with the Confederate flag. I mean, that's what the Confederate flag actually is. When people stand up and say, no, this is heritage, not hate. Standing in defiance against the history of how that flag was used after the Civil War. Standing in defiance of why Alabama raised that flag over the Capitol in 1962. No, we're just innocent. We're just, you know, we're just in the heritage. We have heritage, not hate. I mean, that is the most... You're profound. I mean, there are others, but that is the most profound example of it, I think.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel any burden in this comparison from somebody like Toni Morrison?
None.
You don't?
None.
You're 39, 40?
39. I'll be 40 this year.
But you don't feel
no,
a sense of weight?
No, I'm not going to be Baldwin. I'm not. That's not going to happen. You know, it's, I told somebody, James Baldwin is the James Baldwin of this generation. That's not going to happen. And I don't think that's what she was saying. You know, I think other people kind of saw that and heard that, but I don't think that's what she was saying. I think she was saying there's a way of looking at the world that's been missing for her. And when she read the book, she saw that. I am deeply, deeply honored by that. I'm motivated by it, you know, to try to live up to it. I don't feel weighted by it.
Ta-Nehisi, I want to go to a remarkable interview that I've watched and listened to, I don't know how many times on YouTube, Kenneth Clark interviewing James Baldwin, and it's a voice that I thought we should to hear and have you react to.
Jim, what do you see deep in the recesses of your own mind as the future of our nation? And I ask that question in that way because I think that the future of the Negro and the future of the nation are linked.
They're insoluble.
Yeah. Now, what do you see? Are you essentially optimistic or pessimistic? And I really don't want to put words in your mouth because what I really want to find out is what you really believe.
Well, I'm both glad and sorry you asked me that question. I'll do my best to answer it. I can't be a pessimist because I'm alive. So I'm supposed to be an optimist. But the future of the Negro in this country is precisely as bright or as dark as the future of the country. It is entirely up to the American people and our representatives. It is entirely up to the American people whether or not they're going to face and deal with and embrace this stranger whom they maligned so long. What white people have to do is try to find out in their own hearts why it was necessary to have a nigger in the first place. Because I'm not a nigger. I'm a man. But if you think I'm a nigger, it means you need it. The question you've got to ask yourself, the white population of this country has got to ask itself, north and south, because it's one country, and for a Negro, there is no difference between north and the south. There's just, you know, a difference in the way they, in a way they castrate you. But the fact of the castration is the American fact. If I'm not the nigger here, and you invented him, you, the white people, invented him, then you've got to find out why. And the future of the country depends on that, whether or not it's able to ask that question.
Yeah, it's interesting because I get asked by a lot of people, am I optimistic or pessimistic? I don't know that I'm either. The poles of optimism and pessimism feel...
False.
Yeah, and almost unnecessary from the perspective of a writer. You know, I'm here to, you know, sort of observe. I can't tell you what's going to happen, you know, 20 or 30 years. I can tell you what I see right now and what I think.
Are things the same as they were when this interview with James Baldwin took place?
No, they're better. You're not saying that. They're better. But the problem, I mean, but see, that lures us into like the trap of sort of inevitable progress, where we conclude that because, you know, things, you know, have been progressively gotten better over the past 250 years, that things are necessarily better. But let's take it even in the grand sense. I mean, think about the explosion of violence that World War II represents. Like, when we think about history in general, certainly, you know, one could think about, you know, a sense of inevitable progress right up until, you know, Hitler's armies storming Czechoslovakia. But things go backwards, and things can go backwards really, really quickly. It doesn't mean I believe they'll go backwards. It doesn't mean I hope they go backwards. But I think, like, the notion of failure needs to be present in the mind. You know, the notion that success is not guaranteed.
And that's part of your job as a writer.
Yeah, I feel like that right now, particularly because of where African-American popular philosophy is right now. I think for at least for the past 50 years, the guiding idea has been the moral arc of the universe is long but bends towards justice. And I just totally disagree with that. You know, and
Temperamentally or historically?
Both, I think.
Because you can't allow yourself to think.
Well, no, I just feel like it's kind of disrespectful.
The evidence is against it.
Like if you, you know, were somebody who was taken to Auschwitz and killed, your arc ended right there. You died. It didn't bend towards justice. It bended towards injustice. The arc of your particular history ended right there. Eric Garner's arc ended, you know, on that, you know, concrete where he was choked out on that street. That's it. And I know some, you know, people, they say, well, we mean the bigger sense. But see, I think you ought to be profoundly respectful for that individual. That individual is not going to be around to see that bigger sense.
Can I see this other clip? Touches on a theme that you've been involved with as a writer and as a reporter for quite some time, and I think still are. It has to do with incarceration.
Now, there are 20 million people in this country.
He's talking here about the black population in the 1960s.
And you can't put them all in jail. I know how my nephew feels. I know how I feel. I know how the cats in the barbershop feel. A boy last week, who was 16 in San Francisco, told me, I got no country, I've got no flag. Now, he's only 16 years old. And I couldn't say you do. I don't have any evidence to prove that he does. They were tearing down his house because San Francisco is engaging, as most northern cities now are engaged, in something called urban renewal, which means moving the Negroes out. That is what it means. And the federal government is an accomplice to this fact. Now this, we're talking about human beings. There's not such a thing as a monolithic wall or, you know, some abstraction called the Negro problem. These Negro boys and girls who at 16 and 17 don't believe the country means anything that it says, don't feel they have any place here on the basis of the performance of the entire country.
Ta-Nehisi, Baldwin here is talking to a 16-year-old in 1963. You wrote this book for your son, Samari, when he was 15. Does Samari have a country in your view?
Yeah, and I don't think he would say that. You know, God forbid I speak for him, but I don't think he would say that. Yeah, he does. I actually think that's the really terrible part about it. You do have a country. You know, I think, like, during the 60s, there were people who thought that we could divorce ourselves from this, but we can't. We've been here for so long. It would be nice if we could separate ourselves. But
What do you mean it'd be nice if we could separate ourselves?
Well, I mean, you know, again, like coming from a nationalist background, I mean, that's the dream of nationalism. You know, that was the dream of Malcolm X, that we could separate ourselves, that we could divorce ourselves from what this was.
Do you want that?
Do I want that? I don't know. I guess I don't think about it in those terms. I mean, no. No, because I don't know that things would be any better. I mean, we might set up our own country and be just as brutal or more brutal or God knows what we would do. You know, and then I would be forced to, you know, be on the side of those who are opposing that country.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like the fact that I am within a black struggle, within a black tradition right now has everything to do with the power dynamic. And if you shifted the power dynamic, you know, like I don't have loyalty to my skin. You know, there's no, you know, particular thing about people being colored a certain way that ties me to something. I have loyalty to certain traditions, to heritage, culture, you know, that I feel a certain way about. And ultimately, in terms of the politics, toward a particular struggle. But that struggle really is for justice. I mean, if the power dynamic changed, my role would change.
We've talked about your decision to move to France, to Paris. Mm-hmm. How much of it for you has a resonance because of James Baldwin, Richard Wright? Baldwin once wrote, through this deliberate isolation, through lack of numbers, and above all, through his own overwhelming need to be, as it were, to be forgotten. The American Negro in Paris is very nearly the invisible man. What meaning does this year coming have for you?
That's fascinating you read that, because in general, when people have asked me that question, I say it has no relation to Baldwin. You know, when I first went, I wasn't thinking about Baldwin at all. You know, I hope to drink some good wine, eat some good cheese, and some good bread. that's the uppermost in my mind. But, you know, it's interesting. Paris was the first place that anybody actually ever called me a nigger. That happened in January. This woman, who I think was just out of her mind, you know, looked at me. She threw a dirty napkin at me and said, "Quel un nègre." And that was the first time any white person ever addressed me in that way. And I felt nothing. Like, I just didn't care. It was like
a drunk person on the subway.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But see, I wouldn't have felt that here. Well, there's a connection to some sort of power here. That person is, I see that person as part of some larger apparatus that I have a certain history with. That woman obviously is part of a certain apparatus that has some sort of history with the larger black world and with the black diaspora. But this is not my country. I'm not implicated in this.
So you're taking a vacation from your country and from history for a year?
Maybe so. I mean, maybe so. That point about being feeling invisible is very, very true. When I speak, what they hear is not a black person speaking. They hear an American speaking poor French.
And that's a convenience of sorts.
Yes, yes, yes. It's a mask. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, you actually, you know, you're somebody different, by which I do not mean that France is less racist. I just want to be, I don't mean that. But I mean specifically individual me.
Are you leaving your very newfound fame? Because it's not fame for being on Dancing with the Stars. It's fame for being, you're going to forgive me, a spokesman of some kind.
I hate that aspect.
I know you do.
I don't want to be a spokesman. No one should look at me to be a spokesman for anybody.
But too bad. I mean, you've got it on you. I mean,
I'm conflicted. I'm very happy that people are reading the work. I'm very, very happy about that. I'm happy about the number of people that read the case for reparations last year. But I don't have any need for people to know who I am.
I think for some readers, they leave your work impressed in many ways. But you know the classic story about all Hollywood pitches about stories. Everybody always ends the pitch by saying, but in the end, it's a story about hope.
Jesus. That's abominable.
Which is very funny, but this is not necessarily that. Where does any optimism that you have reside?
I am very happy that I've lived long enough. You know, I'm saying this at 39. I hope to live, you know, a lot longer. To be an observer of the world. To be, as far as I'm concerned, on the right side of a really, really important struggle, I take tremendous pride in that. That makes me feel good. It does not matter if that struggle is ultimately successful or not in terms of how I feel. If I knew today that, you know, white supremacy ultimately triumphs and this is how the country is until the end of its days and that it ultimately destroys the country, I still struggle. It gives my life meaning. Mm-hmm. Makes me feel good. I can't define my hope by whether, you know, I will ultimately be successful. That's not completely up to me. You know, what's up to me is, you know, that I get up every day and I try to be honorable. I try to struggle. That's the portion that's up to me. That's where my hope and faith resides. You know, what the universe does and what happens, that's not mine.
Ta-Nehisi Coates just won a MacArthur Genius Award, and he's the author of Between the World and Me, which is a nominee for the National Book Award.